Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This is February 2nd, 2016 edition, episode 75.
Wow.
Of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico with our live studio audience.
Yay!
Our thanks to Aphrodite for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. We're joined today by independent journalist Corey Morningstar, who is calling in from Ontario, Canada. We begin today's show with an explanation of what we are trying to accomplish with this and upcoming episodes.
Why don't you do that?
I'm going to do that right now, guy.
All right.
We use this format about once each month. We started 2 months ago with an episode focused on Michael Mann and his work, and our second effort was focused on Catherine Hayhoe's work last month. We complain about mainstream media being bought by special interest groups like those who run the fossil fuel industry. We rarely complain when our experts are tied to an institution, organization, business, or even a paycheck. The fact that someone is giving them a paycheck should be a red flag. Not everyone gets a paycheck. I don't. Guy doesn't. Corey doesn't. In fact, none of the major contributors to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network receive a paycheck. We are not on the payroll at PRN, nor have they ever asked us to edit or censor our content. There are no sponsors on PRN. We are not governed by the FCC. We can say whatever the fuck we want, when we want. Today, we continue our series of episodes focused on leading scientists and public figures who have major voices. They are vital to the flow of information heard by most people. The general citizenry receives information from leading climate scientists and activists who work for different institutions and organizations. We are not saying they have all been bought. We are saying they are censored, whether it be by the institution or organization they work for, or self-censorship in response to potential action taken against them. They are paid. We are not. With this episode and others in the future, we will highly encourage anyone who receives significant airtime on major media outlets to become quote-unquote free agents. This isn't to say that you can't have a job or make an income. We are, however, saying that if you are a leading voice in environmental justice, social justice, or climate science, your voice and your word are suspect. In order to become a trusted member of information exchange, a sacrifice is required. Actually, it only feels like a sacrifice until you've taken the steps we have taken. Leaving the institution or organization that pays you will set you free and give the public a reliable voice. We here at NBL are not well-known or leading voices in the mainstream media, yet we have taken steps to be considered reliable voices. Please join us in supporting those who must take such a step. The echo chamber must become quiet. This week, we're pointing out the discrepancies between Miss Naomi Klein's public statements and reality. It's a call-in show, and it's also a call-out show. Please give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888, as we call out Miss Klein for her inconsistencies.
Thanks, Mike. According to her own website, NaomiKlein.com, Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author. She is a contributing editor for Harper's and reporter for Rolling Stone, and she writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian that is syndicated internationally by the New York Times Syndicate. This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, debuted at number 5 on the New York Times list and was named to multiple best of 2014 lists. This Changes Everything is being translated into over 20 languages. Actually, that should be more than 20 languages, not over 20 languages. I think an award-winning journalist would know proper English usage. Maybe Klein doesn't write the content for her own website. If that's the case, you should hire somebody familiar with the English language to write for her. Klein has been called the anti-capitalist capitalist. She and her husband have generated quite a fortune railing against the system from which they have benefited and continue to benefit. Klein is a member of the board of directors for 350.org, a global grassroots movement to solve the climate crisis, and that, for me, is all I need to know about Klein and her work. She is a board member for 350.org, an organization I've repeatedly pointed out for its malpractice. There is no solving the climate crisis. It's a predicament, not a problem. And promoting civilization to address a predicament resulting from civilization is ridiculous. As Mike said, we are joined today by independent journalist Corey Morningstar. Corey has been a major contributor to this show, and she's a prolific writer. She has thought deeply and written prolifically about Naomi Klein's work. Thank you for joining us today, Corey Morningstar.
Corey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
All right.
Good to hear from you.
Likewise. So, you sent me just this morning a great quote from Ms. Klein, and bear in mind that this is from the author of a book subtitled Capitalism versus the Climate. And here's the quote from Ms. Klein. I have never said that we need to slay, ditch, or dismantle capitalism in order to fight climate change. End quote. So get us started, Corey. Seemed like a good place to start to me. If it's really climate versus capitalism, and she says capitalism is something we can't get rid of, it sounds like the climate has won, and we haven't even started yet.
Well, right now I'm just basically finishing up a series I've been working on for the past, about a year and a half on the divestment campaign. And I'm up to, it's pretty intense. It's part 13, 14. Anyway, this piece, again, focuses specifically on Klein. And while I was writing it, I came to the realization that our whole movement, what I say that in quotations, our whole movement, I've noticed something sort of compelling. I see that we've basically, collectively, been conditioned to believe that anthropocentrism is environmentalism. And when I say that, I'm talking about basically placing the belief that humans are at the center of the universe based on human values and human experiences. And anthropocentrists are environmental activists. And this is what sort of I'm concluding. And I would have to say this is social engineering at its very best, you know, and I guess we have Rockefeller and other foundations to thank for that. So maybe we should start off there. What do you think about that?
Yeah, tell us about that connection between Rockefellers and Naomi Klein and the work that she puts out.
Well, Rockefeller, Ford Foundation, there's been many foundations that have backed Klein's book and film. I'm not sure of the date. I don't have it right in front of me, but I think going back to 2011, financing was secured through Klein's project under the name The Message. And that's gone on to be called This Changes Everything. And if you see, we saw that at the big 2014 People's Climate March, which apparently, so they say, brought out around 400,000 people. And you saw WWF, Avaaz, everyone using this term to change everything we need. Everyone, you know, all these different takes on This Changes Everything, which basically created the foundation for the whole green economy to go forward, rebranded as the new economy. And no one better explains that than 350's partner, Avaaz, through their sister organization, Purpose, which is founded by Jeremy Hyman, Hyman's and one other Avaaz founder. They speak very clearly about creating this new economy, formerly known as the green economy, where we're going to put everything into place and we're going to do it. We're just not going to tell anyone that we're going to do it, that we're going to do it. And so decades of planning, you know, this, quote, green economy, which was very, very unpopular a few years ago, they don't just get tossed aside because the public doesn't want it. I mean, they go back to the table and they figure out, okay, how are we going to bring this forward? People hate this. We're going to put it into place. And how are we going to do it? And they go from there. And so what we see is like a huge barrage of celebrity activists who, you know, let's face it, American has some sort of fetish with celebrity. And they're really, they're really brought on board to push forward. To push forward the, you know, the plans by the elite. Everything's coming together as planned. I mean, there's no resistance. I was thinking that was like popular resistance, and I'm thinking we don't need any more popular resistance. We need unpopular resistance. You know, there's no pushback. The state couldn't care less about petitions and, you know, street marches and that. They really can't care less. They only fear, you know, they fear anything happening to the system. They fear losing their power. They fear, you know, the loss of capital. So, I mean, we have the nonprofit industrial complex basically insulating the system. And for some reason, and we have people who are happy with this. I mean, I think it's all about privilege. When I use the word anthropocentrism, I'm not, you know, we have to take it to another level because it's not about all humans. This is about white humans. You know, and right in here with this movement, there's not a care about imperialism. Like, we don't even speak to that. And for an example, in Klein's book, over 500 pages on climate change, the word indigenous is mentioned about 130 times, and yet the word, any kind of word, imperialism, anything, it's mentioned one time. I mean, and we can't talk about it because this whole industrial revolution for renewable energies is based on expanding imperialism. So therefore, how can we even talk about it? I mean, this isn't about protecting nature. This is about protecting lifestyles of the elite.
You know, I'm reminded when you're talking about resistance there at the beginning, I'm reminded of a quote from Howard Zinn. Civil disobedience is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is that people all over the world have obeyed the dictates of leaders, and millions have been killed because of this obedience, end quote. And so that's where we are. We're not willing to resist anybody or anything. We just continually capitulate to the system that's killing us and everything else.
I don't know if we're aware of anything to resist in some cases.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not obvious.
No.
Right? There's no...
I was just going to say, like, it's happened so slowly that people have been so indoctrinated. So it's like a pathology of, you know, passive, I can't even say it, pacifist. It's just, I mean, it's so watered down. It's just pathetic, you know. It's embarrassing. And it's crazy. And if you look at, if you spend a day listening to somebody like Omali, what's his name? Omali Yeshitela, amazing black leader. You'll quickly realize how brutally deficient our quote environmental leaders are. I mean, it's just brutal, you know. And I really don't know what to say. I mean, people don't want to hear what they don't want to hear, and it doesn't matter what you tell them and what kind of facts you have behind you. If they don't want to hear it, they just don't want to hear it. So basically what I'm doing is just leaving, you know, basically like you guys, I guess, just leave, and you might leaving a record, you know, what happened.
Right. We're witnesses at this point. We're not exactly pointing a way that many people are willing to follow.
No. Most of the time I just get a blank stare and then they walk away. But
well, at least you don't get punched in the throat anymore.
No, I think Corey said it right. I mean, it's been so gradual and so, and now it's so watered down that most people don't, it's not even a blip on their radar. It's, you know, when you bring something up like that, I mean, and quite frankly, I sound like a conspiracy theorist about the things I talk about. I'm looked at as semi-crazy or...
Well, you're completely crazy, and conspiracy theorist is a term promulgated, as you know, by the CIA in 1967 to disparage people who didn't believe lifelong liars.
And it worked.
And it worked brilliantly. So now anytime you bring up any conspiracy fact or potential conspiracy, you're denigrated as a conspiracy theorist. Upton Sinclair's quote about fascism coming to America wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross comes to mind. You know, and it's a steady creep in the last 100 years since he said that that gets us right here where we are.
Right.
With almost nobody willing to resist the dominant paradigm.
Corey, is Naomi Klein or anyone really addressed the in public the Rockefeller connection?
I have an email that someone sent me talking to Bill McKibben about, it was from a group in Thailand who was affiliated with 350, and they were really concerned about that connection. And he replied saying that they were really good people now. And he was really, and then right after that, around the same time, he was on the Karen Strickler show, saying that he had no idea where his funding was from.
Right, and Karen Strickler.
Yeah. And that was,
who's had a change of tune herself, hasn't she?
Yes, she has. But it's just sort of ironic, because in Klein's old books, which were really left leaning, Shock Doctrine, she talks extensively about what was it, Milton Friedman, the Chicago Boys, that type of thing, who worked for Ford. And now she's taking money from Ford, the Rockefellers. It's just, Lannan Foundation, who she's connected to, they were actually funded by a company that was integral to the Allende government being, you know, the coup in Chile. And so there's all these things that are so convenient just to look away and not address. I'm not sure when it was, a couple years ago, the only time I'd ever actually addressed Klein on Twitter, and I asked her a few questions, and I put them on my Facebook today, my stupid Facebook. Anyway, they were, you know, critical questions about the war in Libya, about her partners, Avaz, being integral in, on that war, that invasion that's killed hundreds of thousands of people. And I, you know, said, why don't you blow the whistle on your partner, Avaz? Isn't that what investigative journalists are supposed to do? And I asked 4 questions, and I was immediately blocked. And, you know, which, to me, it says everything. And, I mean, it's disgusting to look away from what's happening in the Middle East and not take a position against it. Like, it really is.
You can't sell books that way, Corey.
No, I guess I can't. Sorry, go ahead.
Apparently... everybody has their price, and I'm surprised at how low the price is for some people. You know, Bill Nye, for example, came and visited the homestead here and did an episode for National Geographic, and then shortly thereafter, he comes out falling in love with Monsanto and GMO food, genetically modified organisms, and Neil deGrasse Tyson. At the American Museum of Natural History, the same sort of thing. He disparages people who aren't pro Monsanto because of their GMO stance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. Like right now, you've got Vandana Shiva aligning herself with a group, a campaign called Claim the Sky, where we actually humans claim the sky, and it's all the group that she's aligned herself with are the key players behind the financialization of nature, which is one of the 3 pillars of the green economy, now called the new economy. And it's assigning a monetary value to every single every single piece of nature on this planet that provides a service to humans. And, you know, I just think, wow, that's incredible, you know, and it's sad. And Klein's book, the whole book, 500 pages, no mention of financialization of nature, which is happening right now. There's legislation being put into place to allow that to go forward. They've been working on it for years and years and years, if not decades, because all this stuff that we see has been worked on for decades. I mean, even GMO rice, you can take that right back to the 1930s to the Rockefeller Foundation.
Well, yeah, and when, you know, we talk about ecosystems and we describe what they provide for us as ecosystem services, because they're services for us, because we're so human-centered culture, we don't even think to call them services provided by ecosystems for ecosystems, because the ecosystem, they don't matter except how they matter to us.
No, so this whole thing is payments for ecosystem services, and if you Google that term, you're going to find thousands and thousands of hits, and it's all connected to the UN Millennial Goals. It's a huge, massive thing, and you've got, oh, what a conspiracy theory. You've got not one NGO in the world talking about it, none. That's happening now. It's not a conspiracy theory. That's a conspiracy of what is factual and happening as we speak. And
right,
you've got no one talking about it. You've got people saying, oh, new economy, but no one asks what that new economy actually is comprised of, and no one says.
The campus where I used to visit every day and got paid to visit, even 10 years ago, they were heralding ecosystem services and attempting to assign monetary value to them, and not ever questioning. And this is in a school of natural resources and the environment, never questioning the monetization on behalf of humans and what it might cost in terms of other species.
Right, because they're actually promoting it and putting people out there to participate in it.
Right, absolutely. And so, you know, I was part of the show that was putting on the show without any questions about how the show is being put out there.
Well, and then there's the huge elephant in the room, which is the fact that right now we have a global economic system in collapse and despair. As Larry Summers said last October, we're flying close to stall speed. I mean, we don't ever have that many opportunities in history since the system came into effect that we can actually, you know, have a chance to take the system down. So I thought this was all about, you know, anti-capitalism, and yet we're struggling to maintain and expand the system. Right? It doesn't really matter what you say if all your campaigns work towards expanding the system, protecting the system, keeping the system afloat. The whole divestment campaign, again, like they're looking for trillions and trillions of dollars to keep the system afloat. Why are we keeping it afloat?
Well, Larry Summers is right. You hit stall speed, the whole thing's going to collapse. You know, Edward Abbey wrote this 40 years ago, and I'm going to paraphrase here. Civilization, like an airplane, remains aloft only when it is moving forward. If it's not moving forward, if it's not growing, it's
right. It's completely stagnant. I mean, that's why we have oil being pumped into the ground, right, into salt cisterns. We've got, I mean, there's not even anywhere to put it. So why aren't we seizing the moment?
Right. Why aren't we seizing the moment if the goal is to dismantle the settled living arrangement, which is so
right, but it's not the goal. The unspoken goal is to insulate the set of living arrangements for the 1% that create 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions, the global greenhouse gas emissions. The real goal is to preserve it. Right?
It's almost as if we're not hearing the whole truth about the situation.
And I mean, foundations and oligarchs, the empire does not pump trillions of dollars into organizations that threaten your power structure. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that This Changes Everything has the word indigenous more than 130 times. How many times has Naomi Klein ceded power to indigenous people? Is that in there?
No.
That's crazy talk.
I know that's crazy talk.
And I think that was laughing. one of the questions I put to her in the in my little infamous Twitter exchange. I asked her, I brought up about 2009 at COP15 how Bolivia and the G77, a few other tiny little countries, you know, that will suffer the worst effects of climate change, were putting forward radical targets, you know, the necessary targets. And then Tick, 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 which was actually founded by 350 Greenpeace and Avaaz and 17 other organizations, came in and completely saturated everything, demanding, quote-unquote, demanding 2 degrees, and just completely marginalized and made invisible the demands of the indigenous in the G77 and all those tiny nations full of indigenous people. So there's one really good example. And then the other one would be, I mean, that's before Klein came on board at 350, but she, being an investigative journalist, she certainly should have known about that or figured it out along the way. And then there was the People's Agreement in Cochabamba, Bolivia, which followed in 2010. And 350 went down there and undermined the entire government, who actually a poor government paying for wealthy Americans to fly in there and participate. You know, so just imagine, that's really disgusting to go in and undermine a government on their radical position. So you're in, you know, one of the founders there, we were arguing outside, and she said to me in a rage, she said to me, 350 is the most powerful brand on the planet.
Wow.
And we will not go to 300. We will not support 300. So myself and the former leader of the Green Party in Canada, we had to go to the plenary, and we fought it out in the plenary. And, 350 didn't get their way, and then they did not support the agreement anyway, they wouldn't have anyway, and the whole nonprofit industrial complex buried that agreement.
Well, and never mind that 350, the brand, has nothing to do with reality anyway. By the time they came into being, by the time they took their first significant action, there was already journal literature pointing out that the temperature associated with the current level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is locked in for at least the next 1,000 years. That was when carbon dioxide was at 385 parts per million. So if they had been paying attention to the science they say they're paying attention to, they would have known that we were locked in to 6 degrees Celsius temperature rise and at least 20-foot sea level rise. And that we've known since February 2009, before they made a splash at all.
That's a lot of stationary change. Can't change the name.
Yeah, and even right. that, if you go back to 1990, you can find on documents by both Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth recognizing that, United Nations group guy, you know which one I mean.
Yeah, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases report.
They referred to that document and completely recognized at that time 1 degree was the max that we could go. And then jump forward, 15 years, and they're at COP15, quote-unquote, demanding 2 degrees.
Yeah, that's right. Speaking of climate change, we have a new bit of media, right, Mike? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we'll come back to Corey in a minute. We're going to play a song that I received from a guy named John E. Devlin, who's a Brit, who listens from China, and he's a fan of the show. And he was kind enough to send this tune, and it's very poignant. And I believe the band name is Contraplans, and the name of the song is Facing Up. So let's take a listen.
Thank you. have myself decked out at the Apple Store. A larger phone, a smaller iPad, and replace those damn headphones. Never spare the thought for where it all comes from. Assembled in the hands of slaves and furnished with those complete minerals. The constant flow of wealth, where does it go? Facing up to a plausible outcome that we can't control. Facing up. In the stalls, we never spare a thought for what we might have lost. I wonder why it's harder to exist now than it's ever been before. When there's no options left, where do we go? Facing up to a
Facing Up by ContraPlans, and it was written and performed by John E. Devlin. I'm just going to read the chorus, so in case you couldn't hear it. Facing up to a plausible outcome that we can't control. Facing up to a world where nothing grows. Waking up to a world of consequence like we've never known. Waking up when there's nowhere else to go. Guy?
Love those lyrics. It's emblematic that people who are writing songs and making fiction movies and writing fictional books, they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
But in the real world, where people are doing nonfiction, nobody's telling us what's happening.
Can't sell books.
And ultimately, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? I mean, if we're monetizing ecosystem services, then we're willing to monetize anything. We're willing to monetize the air, and Canada has been selling air to China lately. If we're willing to monetize the air, then apparently we're willing to monetize anything. We have a caller.
All right.
Andrew from Ohio. What do you got for us? Andrew from Ohio, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, so I've got a question for Corey. I'd just like her clarification. Is she still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Okay, so you've seen how Paul Kingsnorth has written that, quote-unquote, climate change isn't something that a small group of baddies has foisted on us. And the minute, so basically he's just making the argument that that the idea that, say, a brutal 1% has screwed over the planet and the noble 99% opposes them and hasn't done much of anything to contribute to climate change. Basically, Paul Kingsnorth has said that that is, obviously you can see how that's an idea that displaces guilt, you know, onto the elites, and it sort of, you know, helps us to feel better about ourselves. But you've noted how 1% of the world's population has yielded 50% of the world's greenhouse gases. So when you say that, it seems as though there's something plausible to say that a brutal 1% has sort of, you know, screwed over the planet for the rest, you know, the world's poor. So
yeah,
wondering if you could you just clarify this for me?
Well, I just know from Occupy when people say, when they were basically demanding a bigger piece of the pie, and it was like the 1%, and we are the 99%. Well, the 1% is actually anyone that can get onto a plane, right? I mean, the majority of the world, I think it's something like 98% of the population has never been on a plane. So when we talk about the 1%, that includes us and most of the people that say that.
So. Yeah, I think I should also point out that we have this thing called culture that we essentially all capitulate to. And there has been a significant role of a relatively few people in promulgating this culture. And here I'm thinking of the people we typically think of as the 1%, whose messages get to trickle down through the mainstream in the films we see and so on. I mean, 10 years ago, there's a story in New Yorker magazine pointing out that Jackson Pollock became a household name, became an artist of renown because the CIA wanted him to become an artist of renown. And so there are entities in the government, in the corporations, influencing the messages we hear. And for the most part, those of us who are part of this culture capitulate to those messages without question.
Right.
And so I think you're bringing up an important point, Andrew, that there's a fuzzy gray area here between us and them.
Yeah. We don't like to be complicit.
Right. And yet,
exactly,
we're all complicit.
Well, while that song was on, it's racking my brain about that, this book I'd read quite a while ago, because I was really interested on, like, sort of the nonviolent direct action dogma. And I just wanted to cite it, Pacifism as Pathology, by, I think it's by Ward Churchill.
Mm.
And it's really interesting. I don't know if this is changing the topic, but I wanted to quote something out of Derek Jensen's upcoming book, Bright Green Lies, which will lend to the conversation. Do you mind?
No, go ahead.
Okay. There's Naomi Klein, who states explicitly in the film, this changes everything. Quote, I've been to more climate rallies than I can count, but the polar bears, they still don't do it for me. I wish them well, but if there's one thing I've learned, it's that stopping climate change isn't really about them, it's about us, unquote.
Right, this is, you know, there's a guy, a conservation biologist, who wrote a book 40 years ago. The guy's name is David Ehrenfeld, and the book title is The Arrogance of Humanism.
Mm.
That comes to mind for me on a pretty regular basis, especially when I hear things like that. It's not about the polar bears. It's not about the ecosystem services. It's not about the ecosystems providing the services. It's about us. And mostly, it's about privileged Caucasian people in the global north.
It's about accessibility, making more accessible for more people. That's what we claim.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it's about privilege.
Right. Well, yeah.
And it, the irony is, if we had to put nature ahead of us by default, we would have saved ourselves, you know, a long, long time ago. But, I mean, we can't even think. We're so devolved at this point. We don't even have the capacity to think like that.
No, we don't even know what that would – people can't even fathom what that would look like, let alone possibly entertain just the concept of it.
Right. When it comes down to the nuts and the bolts and the specific how do I conduct my life, how do I carry out my day, that's beyond our imagination, therefore beyond our ability to act.
And that's usually when people come back with, well, what do you want us to do, go live in caves again?
Yeah, right. Here, have some toilet paper on your way out the door.
Same with me. I mean, it's to a point I'm so domesticated and have been so indoctrinated, and I'm still daily peeling back layer upon layer upon layer, and I keep trying to put a book out, but every time I try to finish it, something else comes up where I'm like, oh, I never thought of that. Now I got to rewrite that entire section. So, yeah, I mean, it's a complete cluster mindfuck, and it's a daily looking in the mirror and going, okay, where am I going with this, and am I going nuts?
and with this show, we're not trying to tell people that they need to live in a cave and suck guts out of bugs for their nutrition. That's not our point. Right. It's not going to matter, and that's not our point. Our point is to ask questions, is to point out to people that there are things you're not being told about this culture and about how we live every day. And you might want to think about this and that and 15 million other things.
At the very least, yes.
Right.
And the whole issue of, you know, this crazy push for a third industrial revolution based on renewable energies on the premise that everything's made by butterfly kisses and magic wands. Like, it's, you know, it's crazy. And it's just another driving force in imperialism. And to deny what we've done to get to this point, I mean, where we want to go, where, you know, the quote-unquote left or whoever, the progressives, whatever you want to call them, the psychophants or the funders, where they want to go, will just make things so much worse. I mean, we're just perpetuating a suicidal system, and then, I mean, but who cares, right? Because we're not at the brunt of it. We're up at the top, you know, reaping the rewards. I mean, there are people, honestly, no one's looking at the bottom. I mean, it's really, really racist.
Yeah. You know, I used to teach this from this paper. It was published in Bioscience, I think, in 1987, but I'm going from a memory that's now almost 40 years old. And the paper found that in, I believe it was 1900, humans co-opted 1% of the net primary productivity, the photosynthesis of the Earth, for their own use. So humans were using 99% of what the planet was growing as a result of photosynthesis, thereby leaving 99% for all of the other organisms on the planet who were taking advantage of photosynthesis by eating things.
So you're using 1%.
We were using 1% in 1900. And by 1985, we were using 40%.
Okay.
Thereby leaving 60%. What do you know? Some of those species have been driven to extinction, and the population numbers of the others are way down. And nobody really asks the question. I don't think there's been any follow-up work, because it would be too terrifying.
Oh, man.
Can you imagine that now, 40 years later, or 39 years later, that we were only using 40% of the primary productivity of the planet?
Right.
No way. No way. It's got to be well over 50% at this point. And we just take that as a given, just like we do ecosystem services that are here to provide for our enjoyment and convenience.
Or population growth. I mean, I don't know what the world population was in 1900 or what it was in 1985. But population rarely comes up either, and what that population's pursuing. You know, we always talk about quote-unquote developing countries and, you know, their population growth, but we never talk about the population of North America and specifically the United States and the amount of resources that we're hoarding and using. You know, one American uses the same amount of resources as 33 Kenyans. So when, you know, somebody decides, well, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to have Billy, and then I'm going to have Sally because, you know, he needs a playmate. Well, right. That's, you know, 66 Kenyans.
Yeah, 74. Right. But whatever. It's a lot. I mean, because – and that brings up the central role not only of the number of people but what those people do.
Yeah.
And we consume like there's no tomorrow in this country and throughout the global north for the most part, thereby assuring that there is, in fact, no tomorrow.
In the way we go about getting those, protecting our interests, quote unquote.
Right.
By, you know, drone strikes and massacring people. Right. It's all a negotiation. It's all negotiating with what's never been negotiable. And eventually – well, negotiations will be over.
Yes. And a catchphrase comes to mind. Nature bites last. We're headed that direction. Go ahead, Corey.
Well, I was just going to say this celebrity fetish thing. I can give you a good example. Wrong Kind of Green, which I work on with Forrest Palmer and a few others. This week we put out an article. We republished an article someone else had written a couple years ago, and we added some images. And it was basically called, what's it called? Bono? Is that how you say his name? Bono? I don't know.
Yeah, Bono.
Okay, Bono, a complete fraud, right? Mm-hmm. And so I noticed after we put it up, like literally thousands of hits a day where people click on and read it. You know, and meanwhile, we've got an article on Abbas's latest destabilization efforts in Burundi. This is after Libya. You know, while the destabilization still goes on in Syria, that Abbas has been integral in, and now into Burundi. But no one cares, right?
No, it's all about the headline. I found that out writing for the Good Men Project. If I have a headline that actually has some, you know, substance, nobody reads it. But if I put a catchy, you know, a celebrity name in it.
Like mine? Are you using mine a lot?
No, Aaron Brockovich.
Oh, whatever.
Or if I say something like near-term human extinction, then people kind of go, oh, wait a minute. But, you know, if it's scientific.
What if you say near-term human extinction by Aaron Brockovich?
Well, it would go off the charts. I would have a number 5 bestseller. And I wouldn't be talking to you.
But I mean, what does it say when we choose, when we fawn over celebrities such as Leonardo DiCaprio, now the face for the United Nations, the face for indigenous rights, the face for climate change? I mean, he's probably the most rapacious person, on the planet. Yeah. And so what does that say about our culture?
Says white men are considered the experts in everything, apparently, still.
Yeah. Well, a bumper sticker comes to mind. There is no secret elitist conspiracy to conquer and enslave the world. They're actually pretty open about it.
Yeah.
We have a name for them. It's white men enslaving the world. And it's right out in the open for anybody who's willing to look.
Right.
You don't have to scratch very far beneath the surface to figure out that there are costs to the way we live.
That's reverse racism, guy.
I mean, the nonprofit industrial complex, the NGOs within it, have to be considered. They're an integral tentacle of the state, of empire, the establishment, whatever you'd like to call it. They're one and the same. I mean, so we're just lying to ourselves and pretending that we're going to solve anything, you know, through this venue. But, hey, we like to lie to ourselves and pretend. Right? Even in what I'm writing right now, I found an old vintage poster, and it says Rinso. And it's, you know, really cool. I like the old vintage posters. And it just sort of reminded me of how Klein is sort of like the Klein-O-Rinso agent for 350.org for Rockefeller. I mean, before she came on board, I think people were starting to say, hey, you know, we can't expect you know, the elites that are behind, you know, whatever, the oppression for the enslavement of the world to actually turn around and solve this crisis. And then, lo and behold, Klein-O-Rinso comes on board, and all of a sudden, you know, McKibben's not that bad after all, you know, and it even goes up the ladder, you know. Rockefeller's not that bad. We love to share articles on Facebook, which I call deep face, but we love to share articles how the billionaires fund the right, but no one wants to know how the billionaires fund the left. right? And why?
Because that's sacred ground.
We don't
fuck with sacred ground, Corey.
Yeah, right. And if you do fuck with it, they hate you for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That hurts my feelings, so.
We can't go there. No. It hurts my feelings.
Insecure white guy.
I mean, I'm looking right in front of me of a poster from last month, Pathway to Paris, a big, fun concert, you know, with McKibben and Klein and Sheba and Tom York and Flea, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's partnered with Ben and Jerry's, Unilever, you know, the United Nations, Tom Steyer's Next Gen Climate. Like, wow, this is what it's come to.
Yeah. It's going to make hell of a movie.
It is
the brave new world of environmentalism.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like I really just can't get over the allegations surrounding the clean, quote unquote clean energy.
Right.
You know, it's like how Forrest Palmer says he prefers, you know, the asshole capitalist to at least tell the truth and tell us, I don't give a fuck, I care about money and profits. You know, so bite me. That's what they say, but it's more honest, right?
Yeah, you know where they're coming from, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Corey.
Thank you, Corey, for joining us. We're at the point where we have to wrap now.
I want to
finish with a line that Mike uses frequently on this show that is a defining element or maybe even a definition of civilization. Quote, they lock up the food. And as we know from Flint, Michigan and throughout China now, they lock up the air and the water as well. And that's what the whole story is about, is providing privilege for a few and locking up the rest and calling things ecosystem services and such like.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your time and your work, Corey.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
You're welcome anytime.
It's a pleasure.
I have a very brief update on the climate front and then something even better.
Okay.
Further research on primary productivity in the ocean was published in the paper in the January 19th, 2016 issue of Geophysical Research Letters. Referring to the Indian Ocean, the abstract concludes, quote, future climate projections suggest that the Indian Ocean will continue to warm, driving the productive region into an ecological desert, end quote. I've added this information to feedback number 23. Here's the good stuff, though.
Okay.
I received an email message yesterday from a self-proclaimed spiritual master and a, quote, visionary and seer of the future.
Mm-hmm.
He writes that his, quote, life work has been about integrating the awareness that our species is dying as well as understanding what role aliens may have in our future evolution, end quote.
Okay.
Uh-oh. I think I know where this is going. Quote, for 20 years I've worked on a spiritual level to understand the matter of human extinction. By 2022, I see that no one could be left here,
wow.
End quote. Yeah, could be. It's a bitterlier than my customary statement, but I'll not pick nits with a spiritual master. He goes on, but as you know the truth, I wanted to point out that not all of us will be wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
As you know the truth, you may not have to die in the collapse of humanity. Some of us may well be going to the stars. There are many other worlds that are habitable, and there are means to get there that many humans are not able to understand.
Ground control to Vegeta.
I wrote about this topic many years ago in an essay at the blog. The essay is titled Earth Egg, and it points out what a silly idea it would be to trash this place and then move on, expecting wholesale changes in human behavior that would preclude us from trashing the next place.
This time, it's different.
Oh, yeah. If we just do the right thing right now.
Right.
Uh-huh. I receive correspondence indicating aliens or God will save us on a pretty regular basis, but this is the first time I've heard that spirits and the aliens are working together on our behalf, but only for a few of us, the few, the willing, the spiritual. I didn't answer, by the way.
God bless you. All right, folks, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show and share the link to our show to your favorite groups, please. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Leighton Woodhouse. If you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at prn.fm or stitcher.com, or rate us on iTunes. You can catch Guy tonight on Gary Knoll at 7 p.m. Eastern with a panel of climate pundits. Thanks again to Corey Morningstar for joining us and to Afrizen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Yeah, she's gonna get you.